New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor Carlos Frankel. His new book is titled Teaching Plato in Palestine, Philosophy in a Divided World. It has just been published by Princeton University Press. Frankel is James McGill Professor in the Departments of Philosophy and Jewish Studies at McGill University. We tend to think of philosophy as a professional academic subject taught in college classes with its own rather specialized problems, vocabularies, and methods. But we also realize that the discipline has its roots in the Socratic activity of trying to incite debate and critical reflection among our fellow citizens. That is, we acknowledge that, apart from its existence as a technical discipline, philosophy is a kind of civic activity that, we hope, can help us address life's biggest questions, even when we find ourselves deeply divided over their answers. In Teaching Plato in Palestine, Carlos Frankel tells the tale of his attempts to recapture philosophy's Socratic dimension. He recounts his adventures in doing philosophy in non-standard contexts with atypical interlocutors and in unfamiliar places. Along the way, we see a hopeful and encouraging vision of philosophy emerge as a collection of rational techniques and intellectual virtues that can, indeed, rescue our individual and collective lives from impending incivility. As usual, there's a lot to talk about, so let's turn to the interview. Hello, Carlos Frankel.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
Very well. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thank you for joining for New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you for having me and for giving me a chance to talk about the book.
And that's perfect. Thank you, listener, for checking out the podcast. Today, my guest is Carlos Frankel. His new book is titled Teaching Plato in Palestine, Philosophy in a Divided World. This book is fascinating in lots of respects, but one of which is that it's partly a kind of intellectual travelogue. Carlos takes us on a few philosophical adventures where he practices philosophy or teaches philosophy or talks about philosophy in unexpected places with unexpected communities. But the book also defends, at the end, manifests and practices a powerful vision of the role that philosophy can play and perhaps should play in our lives, both locally and interpersonally and globally. Teaching Plato in Palestine, then, is really engaging. It's beautifully written as well, and so I highly recommend it to anybody who might be listening to the podcast. But before we get into or plunge into some of the details, Carlos, we usually start with a bit of biography from the author. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Thank you above all for your kind words about the book. So people might already have guessed by my accent that I am not an Anglophone by birth. So I was actually born in Germany, but two parents were both born in Brazil and who arrived in Germany just before I was born in 1970 as political refugees. And so I spent my childhood in Germany, but when I was about 10, we decided to go back to Brazil. My parents decided to go back home, so to speak. And what was home for them was in some sense exile for me. So there was really a tremendous culture shock when we relocated from Germany to Brazil and from a small town in Germany to São Paulo. Everything was somehow different there from climate and food and etiquette and social rules. And I remember being really struck by the fact that my new classmates had never heard of the childhood books that I had grown up with, the heroes that shape every German boy's imagination, so to speak. And I had a very funny reaction to that experience, to this experience of culture shock, and that was idealizing or glorifying everything German and putting down everything Brazilian. Now, in retrospect, I'm of course embarrassed by these very, biased teenage judgments, but I think it was also sort of a first attempt to somehow make sense of the world, to defend a certain way of living, to defend certain beliefs. So it was in some sense an initiation into questioning. And this kind of I would say almost a diaspora nationalism, so this kind of Germanophilia, took a heavy hit when my grandmother got really irritated with me. She had been actually she was born in Germany and had to leave when the Nazis came to power, so she has a German Jewish background, and she gave me this book about a kind of photo documentary of the Holocaust, and so my picture of Germany kind of imploded, and I think that some of the philosophical questions that I deal with really go all the way back to this kind of double identity crisis that I experienced when we moved to Brazil, in some sense I see my philosophical career starting there, or at least some of the questions that I've pursued. My father always wanted me to become a carpenter because he felt that I was too much of a Luftmensch, but I didn't follow his advice, and so I did go into philosophy, and I started out actually studying in Berlin in the 1990s, and in the 1990s the analytical philosophy was already pretty strong in Germany, so there were people like Ernst Tugendhat, for example, still teaching in Berlin at the Freie Universität, and I was quite attracted to analytical philosophy at the beginning, to the clarity and rigor of analytical philosophy, but I also felt after a while that somehow the big question that I sort of came in with, that I couldn't really somehow think about these questions within that conceptual framework, and that somehow led me more into the history of philosophy, to engaging with philosophers of the past. And so quite a bit of my work actually has been on the history of philosophy, I think I've always been a bit of a confused person, and part of that confusion was about, my Jewish roots and, to which extent do I identify as a Jew, and so I went to Israel for part of my graduate studies, and I studied at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and I became quite interested in this question, how rationalism is related to religion, and whether being committed to, reason somehow entails a rejection of religion in Israel, as you probably know. There's this rather stark contrast or conflict between a secular camp and a religious camp, and so you have to somehow take sides. And so these kinds of questions started interesting me, and so I spent quite a bit of time thinking about that, and my scholarly work explores some of the issues related to the relationship between philosophy and religion, or reason and religion. And I also became interested in political philosophy, in questions about the conditions of living a good life and so forth, the political conditions of living a good life. And I've been now in Canada for about 15 years, so I got my first academic job at McGill University, where I now teach in the departments of philosophy and Jewish studies. Issues of cultural diversity started becoming interesting to me. As you know, Montreal is one of the most multicultural cities in the world, and I was very fascinated by the idea of living in such a multicultural, such a sort of vibrant city. But I was a little bit disappointed when I got here, because I had this impression that people who come from very different backgrounds and were brought up with very different cultural and religious traditions, in some sense, don't really engage each other. So there was a bit of a disappointment with the Canadian version of multiculturalism, and they started thinking about, are there more productive ways of making use of differences, disagreements, clashes, intellectual clashes that come about because we have these different backgrounds, we belong to these different groups, and so forth. So some of this, I think, is clearly reflected in the book that we're going to talk about. So that's a little bit of my rather eclectic upbringing and I guess intellectual journey.
Well, it's fascinating, because it does make in some ways it makes a good sense of the traveling philosopher aspect of your work. But let's pick up on that. And as a lead into the book, can you tell us a little bit more, in more specific terms, perhaps, sort of about the conception of philosophy that you have? Because it seems that one of the things that drives the book and one of the themes with which it concludes is a sort of conception of philosophy as an activity rather than just a subject that one might study. It's an activity that is in some deep way connected to living a good life. Perhaps it's also in a deep way connected to living civilly with others. But it's also a commitment to a certain kind of, I hope it's not too strong to say, confrontation with others. Can you tell us just in general terms sort of the picture of philosophy that drives the work in this book, at least?
Yeah, sure. So I think the concept of philosophy that I propose in this book is a very deflated one. So I don't speak of philosophy as, let's say, a grand theory like Marxism or so. But what I mean by philosophy is essentially, as you pointed out, is essentially, philosophical techniques, the toolkit of the philosopher, logical and semantic tools that allow us to clarify our views, that allow us to make an argument, that allow us to respond to an argument, and so forth. So basically, the philosopher's toolkit. And then also, I would say, something that one can maybe call the virtues of the philosopher, and above all here, the virtue of loving the truth more than winning an argument, right? So if you want to have the kind of productive discussions that I sought out in these philosophical adventures that are described in the book, then I think you must go into this with the idea of, not somehow convincing your interlocutor of your views, but really you have to go into it as, with a sort of open mind and with the goal of jointly searching for the truth. So this is really, these are the two basic components of the concept of philosophy that underlies this book. So philosophical techniques, philosophical virtues, and part, it's not that I don't think that philosophy cannot be more than that, but I think for this specific project where, I go in and I engage communities that have very different backgrounds and where people, have profoundly different views from my own, I didn't want to go into this somehow in order to convey my own wisdom, in order to somehow convey my own views. So I didn't conceive of philosophy here as a way of teaching something, but really as some kind of foundation for having a productive conversation. And as you said, not just entirely peaceful conversation, but also confrontation where you really discuss about things that you deeply care about, but also deeply disagree on with your interlocutor. So I'm all for conflict as long as it is intellectual conflict, as long as it remains within the realm of debate and doesn't turn into violent conflict. But I think that our differences can be made productive if we channel them into what I in the book call a culture of debate.
Right. But please go ahead.
Yeah. Now in my let's say more scholarly work, my work in the history of philosophy, I've obviously dealt quite a bit with what I would call a heroic concept of philosophy that you can find in philosophers of the past, from Plato to Spinoza. So philosophers who really believe that philosophy is a kind of wisdom that can guide us in life, that can be the basis for building a good political community, that can maybe even console us in times of existential trouble. So I've been fascinated also with this concept, with this much more let's say, powerful concept of philosophy, where, the idea really is that philosophy can be a kind of guiding science. But I think it's a concept of philosophy that is very hard to defend and that is very much tied to metaphysical premises that are hard to defend. And so it was, in some sense, yeah, it was a relief to be able to actually take a certain distance from that and use philosophy really, do philosophy as a practice rather than as a doctrine.
Right, and I take it that, as you say, you know, there's this two-part sort of commitment as philosophy as the kind of practice that you're engaged in the book. But I take it that one of the things that makes you hopeful about that kind of engagement or those kinds of encounters, even when it looks as if the divides are quite deep, is that the philosopher's virtues and the philosopher's aim of searching for truth, that aim and those virtues are not sort of foreign to, people on the street. That is that one of the things that comes up in the book fairly regularly is you will say to one of your interlocutors, you believe things because you think that they're right. And if you think that they're right, you also think that there should be good reasons for them.
Right.
And we're just asking for the reasons that somehow the philosophical activity that you're engaging in is not academic. It's sort of a perhaps more systematized version of the sort of cognitive processes that human thinkers are engaged in any case. Is that right?
I think that's correct. So this book is by no means an attempt to somehow diminish the achievements of academic philosophy or the importance of academic philosophy, but I do try to make a case for also taking philosophy out of the, let's say, traditional academic setting or classroom, and I try to show that one can make it relevant to, let's say, real world concerns or to concerns of people who don't have, academic training in philosophy, who are not academic philosophers. So taking it out into the street, and my sense is that, one can really go back and forth between these spheres. I think we can, make the training that we have received in philosophy useful also outside the academic sphere, that we can use that to help in some sense disseminating this practice of philosophy, right? So I don't see the philosopher in this kind of public role as a teacher of doctrines, but I do see him as someone who can facilitate conversations and who can in some sense provide the tools or lead people to the tools with which these conversations can be conducted. So as someone who disseminates what I call the practice of philosophy.
Well, excellent. So why don't we shift now to actually some of the, as we've been calling them, adventures, and they read like adventures. Maybe we could begin with just the book's title. The book, Teaching Plato in Palestine, begins with five chapters where you describe encounters encounters as a philosopher or as somebody practicing philosophy with people in what we might call non-standard environments. So definitely not classrooms or not standard kinds of classrooms. So why don't we just begin with the experience that you describe in the first chapter, which is the Teaching Plato in Palestine chapter. Can you tell us that story a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So basically, the first part of the book includes these five essays that describe my experience of organizing philosophy workshops or philosophy interventions in different hotspots around the world. And so I've organized these workshops or interventions over a period of 5 years. So the first one took place in 2006 and the last one in 2011. The first essay is also the one that gives the book as a whole its title. So this was a workshop that took place at a Palestinian university, Al-Quds University, which is a Palestinian university in East Jerusalem. And so I went there in 2006 and taught one semester. I taught a seminar at this university, and I taught the seminar together with Sari Nusseibeh, who is a prominent Palestinian intellectual and philosopher. Some of you may actually know his name. And so he was at the time also the president of Al-Quds University, and he was himself a professor also in the philosophy department there. And so we basically co-taught this class, which was a class for advanced undergraduate students, and so we had seven young men and women in the class. And we started out the class with a text by Plato, and hence the title of the book, Teaching Plato in Palestine. And then we also read texts by medieval Muslim philosophers and Jewish philosophers, so Al-Farabi, for example, or Maimonides, who build on Plato and who try to work out what I call an interpretation of Islam and Judaism as a philosophical religion, as a religion of reason. And at the same time, our aim in this class was to use these historical texts, these ancient and medieval texts, as a kind of springboard to also engage with the contemporary concerns of our students, political concerns, religious concerns, and so forth. So that was the basic idea behind this first workshop, and I think it worked out actually quite nicely. So we often were able to go back and forth between these ancient texts and questions that our students were struggling with, and I can give you a couple of examples of these kinds of intersections of historical material and contemporary concerns.
Yes, please do.
So we read, for example, excerpts from Plato's Republic. And so one of the questions that Plato at the beginning of the Republic, in Book 2 of the Republic, tries to ask is, this sort of basic question about justice, whether we value justice for its own sake as something that is intrinsically valuable, or whether we only value justice on account of its consequences, right? So are we just because we want to be just, because we cherish justice itself, or are we just because we want to benefit from the positive consequences of being just and avoid bad consequences of not being just? So are we just because we just want to secure a spot in heaven and avoid burning in hell, or are we really just because we're convinced that justice is a good thing? So that's sort of the basic question that Plato starts the Republic with. As far as I can tell, all of our students were, they were Muslims, and I think they were also all pious Muslims. So to just give you an example, one of the students, a girl by the name of Isma, she at one point during a break in our class, she showed around photos of a wedding that she had attended on the weekend, and some of the photos I and the other men in the class were not allowed to see because she appeared in them without her veil, and being seen unveiled in public by men is considered illicit. So just to show, that our students were quite strict in their observance, in their religious observance. The thought experiment that Plato proposes in Book 2 of the Republic, which is, a famous one, The Ring of Gyges, is, this idea that what would you do if you had, a magical ring that every time you put it on makes you invisible and allows you to commit whatever injustice you fancy without having to fear any kind of bad consequences, any kind of punishment for that, right? And so what Plato is trying to get at is, whether if you had this ring, whether you would actually use it in order to become an unjust person, or whether you would nonetheless remain just because you appreciate justice for its own sake because you think it's intrinsically valuable. And it was very interesting, to see the reaction of the students. So the same student, Bisma, whom I had mentioned before, was actually one of the students who said that if she had this magical ring, the Ring of Gyges, she would actually choose injustice over justice, impiety over piety, because there wouldn't be a reason anymore to be observant, to follow the rules, and so we really got an interesting discussion going about this very basic question, why do we choose to be just or pious, what are the reasons we have for that, and it was really quite fascinating. So that's one example where you can see, in some sense, how religious concerns, became an object of discussion, became an object of reflection. But obviously, these students also had political concerns. And so we also had a very interesting discussion about this question of non-violence, non-violent resistance, non-violent opposition to the occupation. And Sari Nusseibeh was actually one of the most prominent advocates of non-violence in Palestine, in Palestinian intellectual circles. And his basic argument is that non-violence is a good thing for prudential reasons, because it's the most efficient way of getting what Palestinians want to get, namely some kind of political independence and an end of the occupation. And what he says is that Israelis are sort of enlightened occupiers. So he compares them to the British. Non-violence doesn't work in every conflict, but he does think that it would work in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because he thinks that Israelis are sufficiently enlightened to see that if they were confronted with non-violent resistance, they would realize that the occupation is not justified. And in addition, he argues non-violent resistance would secure the entire world's sympathy for the Palestinian cause. So not only would Israelis realize that the occupation is not justified, but there would also be a tremendous amount of pressure on Israel from outside to end the occupation. And so he argues that this is the most efficient way of getting what Palestinians want. And so he thinks that nonviolence is what you should choose on prudential grounds. Now, obviously, one can discuss this argument and raise objections to it, but what was interesting for me is that we had an interesting conversation about this when we again were engaged with the Republic, more specifically when we talked about Plato's moral psychology. So, so as for Plato, the human soul is not just rationality. So we are not just our soul is not just made of reason, but it also has these irrational impulses and desires that often conflict with reason. And Plato thinks that if we don't manage to somehow subdue these irrational impulses and desires, then they might actually get control over our behavior. And so one of the key virtues that Plato recommends in the Republic is sophrosyne, or moderation, self-control. Right, so if you want to live according to what reason prescribes, then you need self-control in order to keep your irrational impulses and desires in check. So the question that we discussed in class was whether this virtue of self-control might, in some sense, be a key to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, precisely because it allows you to control the reflex or the desire to hit back when you get hit, and because it allows you to choose nonviolent resistance, which is, at least according to Nusseibeh's argument, which is what reason prescribes, right? So you can implement the instructions of reason if you have that virtue, and if you refrain from hitting back when you get hit. Again, I think it's sort of a an illustration of how this text in some sense comes to life in this particular context, and allows you to discuss certain fundamental issues that these students were concerned with, and that are obviously not directly tied to this text.
Right. So let me just ask a quick question, especially about the invisibility ring from book two of the Republic. Where you describe a surprising result that a devout Muslim girl would in fact do what Plato's interlocutors Glaucon and Adeimantus say one would do,
right,
which is choose the unjust path when you can do so without the threat of being detected and punished. Did you find in the Palestinian context when you were teaching this material that the student breakdown on the invisibility ring was in any obvious way different from how the students in at McGill, for example, or at Oxford might disagree?
That's a good question. I think the reaction was in some sense different, because when you teach this material to students who are secular, And to the extent that they have some kind of commitment to justice, it is not based on, you know, fear of punishment or hope for reward, right? And so so they already have, I guess, a concept of, you know, justice's intrinsic value that in some sense predisposes them to, you know, to not make use of the magical ring. So I would say that, so if your motivation to embrace, let's say, piety or justice is not, getting a certain reward for your behavior or avoiding a certain punishment for transgression, I think then you are more likely to reject then you're more resistant to the allure of the ring of Gyges. I would say that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Can we move to another context? Would that
be okay? Of course, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was also just interested in the experience that you had with what you call an underground Spinoza seminar in New York.
Right.
Can you tell us?
Right.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So maybe I'll say a little bit about the general project, and then I'll come back to the specific example.
Sure.
So the idea of, you know, of going to these different places and engaging these different groups in these philosophical discussions, so part of the motivation was basically to seek out places of conflict, right? So I did a workshop at this Palestinian university. I did the workshop in Indonesia at a state Islamic university, and then I did the workshop that you just mentioned with a group of labs, the Hasidic Jews in New York City, and then I did some classes with actually high school students in poor neighborhoods in Brazil, and the last workshop took place with a group of Mohawk. With the First Nations community, a Mohawk community on the border between Canada and the U.S., and these are all places in some sense fraught with conflict, different kinds of conflict, of course. So you have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, obviously, that we already talked about a little bit. You have the more general conflict between Islam and the West that, you know, has become important since the end of the Cold War. But you also have a conflict like religious orthodoxy versus urban modernity, as in the case of, you know, Hasidic Jews in New York. You have social and racial divisions in Brazil. And obviously you have the scars of colonial history in First Nations communities and Native American communities in North America. And so part of the basic idea of the book is to show that philosophy, in this deflated sense that I described at the beginning of our conversation, that philosophy can be useful to address the questions that these kinds of conflicts generate, right? Questions about God's existence, the question whether, for example, violence is justified, that we already talked about, how one should live, what is social justice and how can one get there, who should rule, who should count as a member of the community, which are very important questions in these First Nations communities that are trying to regain a certain measure of self-governance or even sovereignty, and that are trying to determine what the boundaries of the communities are. And so this was sort of the general impetus for these adventures and travels. So in New York, I basically found a group of Satmar Hasidic Jews, and the Satmar community is really the most secluded community of all in the Hasidic Jewish world. But these were really Hasidic Jews of a particular type, because, as I mentioned, they were lapsed Hasidic Jews, and they really lived a fascinating double life. Outwardly, they were good members of the community and, you know, practicing Orthodox Jews and, they would go to the synagogue every Friday and Saturday for Shabbat and so forth. So they really kept up these ultra-Orthodox appearances, but inside they were complete freethinkers who had broken away entirely from the Jewish tradition and believed in nothing. So there was a real sort of, you know, fundamental existential intellectual tension, conflict that they were living, and they were in some sense thrilled by it. You know, they really enjoyed this sort of double life, and they felt it as it was an enrichment for them in some sense. I remember, for example, toward the end of this workshop, we actually read some Nietzsche. So again, we started with Plato. We also read Al-Ghazali, and I'll maybe say a little more about Al-Ghazali in a minute. Mm-hmm. Read Maimonides, Spinoza, and then we ended with Nietzsche. And I told them at the end of one class to think about how Plato, Maimonides, and Spinoza would reply to Nietzsche's claim that that God is dead, and if they would have some kind of response to that. And one of them said, thank you so much, Carlos, for giving us this question. So now at least I will have something to think about when I'm praying in synagogue on Shabbat. Something to keep me occupied.
That's amazing.
When I'm trying to avoid listening to the rabbi. So again, you know, we started that that workshop with we read the Apology, we read the Eudipro, and it was very interesting for me to see their reaction to these texts by Plato. So I think one of the rewards of doing this was that I got to see some of the texts, you know, that I had obviously thought about and that I had taught in an academic context, that I got to see these texts in an entirely new light. So one of the things that they were surprised about was that, you know, Socrates really comes across as a rather kind of pious person. And they were really convinced that once you commit yourself to reason, there is no place whatsoever for religion. So they were really, in some sense, you know, quite Manichaean about that. So if you're a rationalist, then you cannot also be religious. And so how is it possible that this founding figure of philosophy is actually, in some sense, you know, seems to be a pious person? He somehow, you know, carries out his philosophical mission after he gets this oracle from Apollo. And he in some sense, you know, is a kind of martyr for philosophy. He doesn't want to give up his philosophical mission because he doesn't want to disobey the divine command. And so they couldn't really get their head around that, that you can be a great philosopher and at the same time, in some sense, a religious person. So one of the theories that they came up with, that one of them came up with, was that Socrates had died too early. And so, you know, so I was really puzzled by that suggestion because, you know, he hadn't died that early, was almost 70. And then so I asked him, you know, what do you mean by that? You know, in which sense, what does Socrates' religiosity have to do with the date of his death? And so he said, well, when I lost my religion, I didn't lose it all at once, but it was really sort of a process, a gradual process. So at first I noticed somehow that the things that the rabbis in our community were saying didn't really add up. And so I decided to go back to the medieval commentaries on the Bible. And then I felt that these commentaries also didn't really make so much sense. And so I went back to the rabbinic classics, to the Talmud and to the Mishnah. Didn't really trust those sources either, and I went back to the Bible itself, and I felt really proud that I was the only one who was following God's true word, and everybody else was being misled by these human interpretations of God's word. And for a while, I became a kind of biblical Jew, but then, in the end, the Bible didn't really hold up anymore either, and that's when the bottom kind of fell out, and he experienced this deep this deep existential and intellectual crisis, and he basically lost his religious conviction altogether. So what he was trying to suggest was that Socrates hadn't quite made it to this final step. right? So he had to, you know, maybe gradually liberated himself from different layers of religion, but he hadn't quite made this final step. And this explained the kind of religious dimension of the portrait of Socrates that you get in the Apology. Yeah, so it was really quite interesting attempt to interpret the Apology. I think one of the most interesting conversations we had was when we read Al-Ghazali. So Al-Ghazali is one of the most important medieval Muslim theologians. He lived in the 10th and early 11th century, and he to this day is recognized as one of the fundamental theological authorities in Islam. And towards the end of his life, he wrote a kind of intellectual autobiography, that was the text that we read together in English translation, of course. And he starts out this intellectual autobiography with an account of his own crisis of faith. And this crisis of faith occurred when he noticed that he would have been just as fervent a Jew or Christian as he used to be a Muslim had he been brought up in a Jewish or Christian community. So he basically realizes that, you know, his strong conviction, his belief in the truth of Islam was not the outcome of rational deliberation and choice, but it was basically the outcome of the contingent circumstances of his upbringing, what he calls the influence of his parents and teachers. And once he realizes that, had he been born into a different community and brought up under different circumstances, he would have been a different person with a different set of beliefs. He basically loses his faith in Islam. And much of the rest of the book is then describes basically his attempt to rebuild his faith in Islam and how he tests different interpretations of Islam to find out which is a true one and so forth. But the students could really relate to this description of his initial experience of crisis of faith. And one of the students actually told me a story that was in some sense related or was based on a somewhat similar experience. And so he said that before he had his own intellectual crisis, when he was still a believing and committed Jew, he would get up very early every morning in order to demonstrate his religious passion by studying Torah even before the sun got up. Even before sunrise, and on his way to the synagogue, he would pass by a mosque, and he would notice that Muslims were already praying in the mosque. And so he thought, if we are both so passionate about our religion that we get up to worship God before sunrise, how can I be sure that my religion is a true one and theirs is false? Right? Somehow, the same kind of passion drives us. So, what gives me reason to believe that that I am right and they are wrong? So we had a really interesting discussion about this question, whether some of our most intimate and fundamental convictions may not be all that well founded after all, but may be the outcome of rather contingent circumstances of upbringing and education and exposure to religious political rhetoric and so forth.
And am I right in remembering that Ghazali actually has a word for this phenomenon, the influence of the contingencies of one's tradition and circumstance?
That's right.
That's right.
So I use this term as a kind of technical term in the book. So basically the Arabic word is taqlid.
Right.
And it's not so easy to translate, but it basically means submission to the authority of teachers and to the authority of parents and teachers in an uncritical way, or the uncritical acceptance of the teachings that one receives from authorities.
And this seems to be one of the threads that connects these encounters, despite the differences between the communities. Each of the communities you engage with seems to have this worry about blindly following the tradition rather than seeing the reasons in favor of it. You keep raising, the Mohawk community seems to have a concern with this as well.
Right.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So I think the Mohawk community is a good example of, where you, in some sense, you don't really have to bring philosophy to them. They're already engaged in a kind of, a vigorous conversation. And in part, that is due to the many differences among different groups in these communities. And these differences are really due to colonial history, right? So you find Catholics there, you find Protestants there, you find different attempts to revive some kind of ancestral tradition, going back to what they believe is, the culture and religion of their ancestors. You find secular people there. And so in some sense, you already have a debate that is due to this fractured colonial history. So that I think also helps to justify doing philosophy in these places. You're not somehow imposing something on them, but you're in some sense facilitating and maybe offering tools to do something that they're already practicing anyway. But the main reason for me to actually choose this community, so the name of the reservation or reserve, I think, in Canada, is Akwesasne, and it's one of the biggest Mohawk reservations in North America. There are about 11,000 Mohawks who live there, and it straddles really the border of U.S. and Canada. So you have actually two national jurisdictions and three provincial jurisdictions. So again, a rather fractured colonial geography. So it's between Quebec, Ontario, and New York. And then you have also three internal governments on the reservation, some of which are supported by Canada, others by the U.S., and some are really sort of try to revive a traditional form of governance and have no support from either country. And so in some sense, it's really perhaps the most governed spot on earth. Two national, three provincial governments and then three internal governments, so altogether I think eight governments, and at least in theory, on the Canadian side, I think the Queen is the one who is still technically in charge. One of the interesting things that I found out was that the ideal of governance is actually no government at all. And so one of the sort of paradoxes I came to appreciate talking to them was that the ideal of the most governed place on earth was no government at all, but the basic question really was about a self-governance agreement that they were negotiating with Canada. So basically this workshop took place on the Canadian side of the reserve, and they were engaged in negotiating with the Canadian government a self-governance agreement. So the idea basically was that they would take charge, at least in part, of their own affairs. So until now, basically, the relation between Canada and its native communities, First Nations communities, is governed by the Indian Act, which goes back to the late 19th century and was a very paternalist framework based on the assumption that Indians couldn't govern themselves and therefore need the federal government to take care of them. And so there is now a push to replacing the Indian Act and the legal framework that it comes with through self-governance institutions. And so the terms of these have obviously to be negotiated. And so this is what this community was engaged in. And that opens up some of the most fundamental questions of political philosophy. So it's in some sense, some of the most basic questions in political philosophy were life questions for them. So if the Canadian, the federal government withdraws, who should then rule? Who should replace them? With what kind of aim should the government rule? What is the idea of let's say a flourishing individual and communal life that should guide the new governance institutions? Who is a member of the community? And all these questions were basically questions that they had to discuss and that they had to come to some kind of answer to. And as I mentioned, because there are so many different factions on this reservation, you know, people have different views on these issues. And so I think part of the attraction for them to have me there and to facilitate a discussion was that, that they really needed to have this conversation. And so they appreciated someone who, in some sense, was neutral, who came from the outside, who, didn't take sides and who had, let's say, tools that would help them to conduct this kind of a conversation.
Excellent. So let's, for the listeners, you know, the narratives that that you tell in the first five chapters are really, really engaging, and the parts in each of the chapters where you reproduce actual bits of dialogue, or you recount actual bits of dialogue, are revealing of all kinds of interesting and in some ways surprising similarities that might be unexpected. So let's now turn to the second part of the book, your part two, which is chapter six,
mm-hmm.
Where you draw some lessons or extract some lessons from these five kinds of encounters. So it looks as if the book ends on a pretty encouraging and hopeful note about the potential for philosophy as this kind of, as you were saying, deflated activity of questioning and debate to help, render civil some differences that are constantly threatening in our present world, or maybe teetering on the brink of incivility.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you draw those lessons out of the five encounters?
Yeah. So I think I have basically two goals in this book. One that I already mentioned, trying to show by example, in a sense, that philosophy can be useful to addressing the kinds of questions that arise from these different conflicts that people were struggling with in these different places that I visited. But at the same time, as you can imagine, in these workshops, different viewpoints often clashed, right? So people would disagree with me, but they would also disagree amongst each other. I just mentioned, the diversity and the fractured nature of the First Nations community. So there were internal disagreements, and so the second main point that I try to argue in this book is that fundamental disagreements, on moral, philosophical, and religious issues are actually not a bad thing, but that they are a good thing as long as we can channel them into what I call a culture of debate, as long as they don't erupt in violence. So a culture of debate on the most basic level is basically an intellectual space where we can discuss things that we deeply care about but also deeply disagree on across cultural and religious divides, right? That's basically what I mean by this notion of a culture of debate. And the idea here is if we imagine, say, humankind engaged in a kind of global conversation, there would obviously be many things that we disagree on, from God's existence and the origin of the universe and how one should live, how one should educate one's children, how one should treat differences between genders, what constitutes good politics, how political power should be related to religious power, and so on and so on, right? So I think we disagree on all these things. Obviously, I think, at least most of us, I think, agree on that we don't want these disagreements to turn into violence, right? So let's say Muslim fundamentalists shooting cartoonists in Paris for publishing caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, or a couple of decades earlier, also in Paris, Christian fundamentalists torching cinemas for showing Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ, which many Christian groups, conservative Christian groups, considered sacrilegious. We don't want that. What I basically argue is that what we also don't want is this kind of multicultural complacency, where we basically say that each one of us is entitled to his or her own opinion, and we are not going to engage with each other, and we will treat all these opinions as equivalent, as equally good. So in some sense, this culture of debate tries to steer a middle way between, I guess, violence, between war and peace, right? So it's war, it's in favor of war, but intellectual war, as it were. So it's in favor of intellectual conflict. Why do I say that, having these disagreements and discussing them is a good thing? To give you a simplified version of the basic argument, the anthropological assumption here is the assumption about human nature here is that we do have a desire to figure out the truth about these big issues that I have mentioned before. So I think most of us feel uncomfortable if we suspect that our views on these issues are false. So I think most human beings want to get to the truth, to get to the bottom of these issues. We all have strong views, or we have views and often strong views on these issues, right? So we have convictions about whether God exists, what the origin of the universe is, how one should treat gender difference, how one should educate one's children, and so on. Having views and even strong views on these issues doesn't entail that we're actually right on them.
Right.
And so if you're willing to concede that, if you're willing to concede that you may be wrong, so if you're basically a fallibilist, if you're willing to concede that the things that you believe are right may be wrong, may turn out to be wrong, then I think you have a good reason to engage in these kinds of debates across cultural and religious divides, because they're basically an opportunity for you to critically think about the convictions that you hold, and these are, as I say, convictions that are quite basic convictions, that are convictions around which we organize our individual and political life. So these are not just frivolous questions, but these are sort of fundamental questions. So in that sense, discussions are all the more productive and interesting if they occur across cultural and religious divides, because then we cannot rely on the narratives that we were brought up with, right? When Jews discuss with Jews and Palestinians with Palestinians and secular people with secular people there's a sort of kind of background, this sort of set of background agreements that doesn't then lead to grappling with the more fundamental questions. But if you have these discussions across these boundaries where you cannot rely on the narratives that you were brought up with, then you're actually forced to argue for your views. So it puts pressure on you to come up with reasons, to come up with arguments, to defend your views, and in that process to also critically reflect on your views.
Right. So this is a very attractive model, at least from my perspective. And I think that from the perspective of philosophers generally, this is a pretty good image of what we do and what we try to instill in our students' interest in doing. Mm-hmm. But you do consider a certain kind of pushback that alleges that your image of the culture of debate is a kind of imposition of a certain Western Enlightenment ideal of the individual and the individual rationality and other kinds of sort of pretty particular cultural and political aspirations that come along with the Enlightenment. Can you run us through what you say about the worry that the culture of debate is really just a subtle form of cultural imperialism?
Right. So, you know, so I came across these objections a few times, and so I felt that I should address it in the book. And I think part of the answer really lies in the first part of the book, you know, where I often use texts, philosophical texts that are tied to the religious tradition of the groups that I am engaging, right? So in order to build on local, you know, traditions of critical reflection and debate. And so, you know, obviously there is a vibrant tradition of philosophical thinking, both in the traditional Islamic world and, you know, in the Jewish tradition. Obviously there is also, you know, a lot of philosophy going on in the Christian world. Now these are the intellectual traditions that I'm more familiar with and that are, you know, more prominent in the book simply because, you know, part of my scholarly expertise lies in these traditions. But obviously there is a very rich tradition of debate and philosophy also, you know, in Eastern Eastern religions, especially in Buddhism, but also to a certain extent in China. Obviously also in Hinduism. You know, so I think as long as one limits oneself to this deflated concept of philosophy, I think one can really find it in a very wide range of religious and cultural traditions. And so, you know, it is at work in these traditions. It's not something that we import into them or something that we try to impose on them. But, you know, people have been engaging with fundamental questions within these contexts, you know, for a very long time. And so, you know, so one can build on those local traditions, I think, of philosophy. And and you know, another objection that I try to address is that fallibilism is something that is very unattractive to religious interlocutors, right? So many of my interlocutors were not secular, but, you know, deeply religious, pious, devout. Is it actually possible to convince them to embrace fallibilism? You know, wouldn't they say that you know, maybe reason is fallible indeed, but this is just a reason to actually not follow reason at all, but to somehow, you know, simply go with faith and, you know, and accept the truth, not based on arguments, but based on faith and, you know, just circumvent, just avoid philosophical discussion altogether. And I think, you know, one might get these kinds of responses, but I actually never got those on the ground. So none of the people, you know, whether Jewish or Muslim or Christian that I actually talked with gave me this kind of reply. You know, they were always actually very interested and willing to engage in the kinds of conversation that I was offering. So, you know, on the ground, I must say I've never met this kind of reaction. And I think one can again also point to a number of texts that help to motivate the kind of fallibilism that I think is essential to this project from within those religious and cultural traditions. And one of these texts is precisely the text that we already talked about, Al-Ghazali's intellectual autobiography, in which he describes, you know, this profound crisis of faith that he experienced as a young man, and that basically triggered the search for the truth of Islam that he then describes in the rest of the book, and where he examines different interpretations of Islam, the competing interpretations of Islam, and at the outset he doesn't know which one is the right one, and you know, and so you know, so this is sort of a model of the kind of quest that I have in mind, and again, you know, Al-Ghazali is not a marginal figure, but it's really the central figure in Islamic theology, and so you know, and I think one can point to other examples that help to show that this kind of approach, you know, is perfectly acceptable within those religious traditions. That doesn't mean that one will get everyone on board, but I think one can show that, you know, quite a few people could come on board and could participate in this without having to, in some sense, betray their religious or cultural tradition.
Well, Carlos, you've been very generous with your time, and it's been really wonderful to talk to you about your book, Teaching Plato in Palestine. Last question I typically ask when we've got a minute. So, what's your next project? Will you do more philosophical traveling?
not on the short term. So I have no other philosophical adventures lined up right now. I'm actually working on something more personal, more subjective, a kind of family memoir. So that's that goes back to the confused person that I am trying to figure out. it's in some sense an attempt to reconstruct the genesis of some of my questions from a kind of family historical perspective. And but philosophically, I think one of the things that I want to explore more is really the meaning of what I called at the beginning of our conversation this heroic concept of philosophy, and whether it has really become indefensible. You know, this idea that philosophy can guide us in our individual lives, in our political life, that it can possibly console us. Whether it is really indefensible and what this loss means for the project of philosophy as a whole. So that's sort of a question that has been on my mind quite a bit and that I hope to be able to engage in the near future.
Well, I'll keep an eye out for that. That sounds fascinating, and maybe we'll have you back on New Books in Philosophy in the future to talk about your future work.
Sure.
But for now, let me just thank you once again for talking about teaching Plato in Palestine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, take care now.
Take care.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Carlos Frankel of McGill University. We were talking about his new book, Teaching Plato in Palestine, Philosophy in a Divided World, newly published by Princeton University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thanks for listening.